Today's sponsor is the amazing Uni Dragon. They create and sell premium sets of wooden jigsaw puzzles and offer jigsaw puzzles for both adults and children to entertain all experience levels. I've recently just started the Majestic Wolf puzzle. It's a super colourful design and is made in wood, which makes it extremely sturdy. What I love about Uni Dragon jigsaw puzzles is that their designs are completely unique, and they even come in their own unique shape, as opposed to just the regular square or rectangular. Their jigsaw puzzles come in a great quality box as well, which makes them perfect for gifts for your loved ones as well. This also makes them really easy to store, if you're like me and enjoy collecting jigsaw puzzles. Jigsaw puzzles are a really great way to pass the time. They're fun and they're a low-stakes activity, which can even help reduce anxiety and increase your memory and problem-solving skills. Listeners of Morbidology have a special discount code for 10% off their order at unidragon.com. Just use their code DRAGONB4. That is DRAGONB4 at unidragon.com. And make sure to hit me up on social media and let me know which jigsaw puzzle you decided on. Before you go any further with this episode, I want you to download the free app Vodacast and listen to this episode there. Vodacast is a podcast player, but what sets it apart from regular podcast players is that they provide deeper digital stories. For example, you could be listening to this episode on Vodacast and immerse yourself in some bonus content, such as photographs related to the case, including photographs of the victim and photographs of the criminal investigation, as well as links to newspaper articles and much more. As you listen on Vodacast, the bonus content appears at the appropriate time in the episode, so you could be listening about certain evidence and see it on your screen for yourself. I'm going to be mentioning certain things that you can see on Vodacast throughout this episode, so download the app now to make sure that you don't miss out. Just click the link in my show notes or search for Vodacast on the Apple App Store or Google Play. Welcome to Morbidology. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, Mysteries Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join Morbidology on Patreon for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, exclusive merch, ad-free and early release episodes, and much more. The provocation defense is an outdated and inappropriate defense which allows killers to claim that their victim had provoked them to commit murder. If successful in such a defense, a killer can be convicted of manslaughter as opposed to murder. Essentially, it rewards lack of self-control by enabling an intentional killing to be categorized as something other than murder. In New Zealand in 2008, a murder trial would cause moral outrage when a shameless killer would desperately attempt to besmirch his victim's name with said defense. The killer's actions in the aftermath of the murder would eventually lead to the demise of the archaic defense. Twenty-two-year-old Sophie Elliott was known as an extremely intelligent, bright, engaging, and fun-loving young woman. She was extremely easy to get on with and was a hard worker. As a young girl, Sophie had learned ballet and also did modern dancing. She excelled in school and was an honour student at Otago University. She loved playing badminton, listening to music, playing the piano, and doing karaoke. In 2007, she completed her studies for an economics degree at Otago University. You can see a photograph of Sophie up on the Vodacast app. Sophie was very close with her family and she lived at the family home in the suburb of Ravensbourne. Her mother, Leslie Elliott, worked as a neonatal nurse at Dunedin Hospital. Her father, Gil, was a scientist and was exceptionally proud of his daughter. He believed that one day Sophie would have been Reserve Bank governor. They often joked that Sophie was their computer and phone whiz kid, and if they ever had an issue with modern technology, Sophie was always on hand to help them out. Sophie also had two older brothers, Nick, who lived in Sydney, and Chris, who lived in Melbourne. In early January of 2008, Sophie was preparing to move to Wellington to begin her new job at the Treasury. She was looking forward to this brand new chapter in her life, and her friends were planning a farewell dinner for the 9th of January 2008. At around 12:30 p.m. on that date, however, police received an extremely distraught phone call from Leslie. She was inconsolable as she screamed on the line that her daughter had been murdered. Shortly before the phone call, Leslie had heard a knock at the front door. When she opened it, she found 32-year-old Clayton Robert Weatherston on the other side. She knew the man immediately. Clayton was Sophie's ex-boyfriend and worked in Otago University. Clayton worked as an economics tutor after completing his PhD at the university. You can see a photograph of Clayton on the Vodacast app. The duo became close and eventually embarked in an on-and-off-again relationship. As Leslie said, the relationship was up and down, either all on or all off. Sophie's parents didn't agree with the relationship and found it to be inappropriate. For one, Clayton had been Sophie's tutor and he was 10 years her senior. Her father said he feared that there was a power imbalance in the relationship. Her parents felt as though Otago University had sanctioned the relationship. The couple had been very open that they were seeing each other. Clayton had told his head of department and the papers that she wrote while in his study group would be marked by somebody else. The relationship was extremely tumultuous and Clayton was constantly putting Sophie down. She went from an extremely confident young woman to constantly second-guessing herself. Her self-esteem suffered greatly throughout the relationship, and Sophie ended up in counselling for what she described as sexual issues between herself and Clayton. Several of Sophie's friends had tried to encourage her to leave the toxic relationship, and somebody even counselled her on ways she could break up with Clayton. Eventually, just the week before Sophie was to leave, she went to Clayton's home to tell him that she was moving to Wellington to begin her dream job, and that their relationship was finally over for good. Clayton didn't take the news well. He restrained and assaulted Sophie. She managed to escape, and a couple of days later, she returned to Clayton's home, kind of as a final goodbye. She had brought along a gift, which was a photo montage from Clayton's graduation. She had told friends that she didn't want to leave with any enemies, so thought it would be best to offer an olive branch of sorts. After Leslie opened the front door to Clayton, he said to her that he had something for Sophie. Leslie thought nothing of it and let Clayton in to the family home. He went upstairs to Sophie's bedroom, as Leslie remained downstairs and carried on like normal. A couple of moments later, Sophie came downstairs alone and said she didn't know why Clayton had come over or what he wanted, adding that he was just sitting there. Sophie went back upstairs and shortly thereafter, from downstairs, Leslie heard Sophie screaming. She rushed up the stairs and heard a series of what she described as rhythmic thumping, followed by a couple of soft sighs. Leslie rushed to Sophie's bedroom, but found that the door had been locked. Leslie's husband had installed locks on the bedroom doors for safety. Leslie ran downstairs to find a meat skewer, which she could use to unlock the bedroom from the outside. She grabbed her phone, and as she was placing a call to police, she managed to get into Sophie's bedroom. Here, she found Clayton sitting on top of Sophie, stabbing her lifeless body. Clayton slammed the door shut in Leslie's face and locked it. By this point, Leslie was on the phone to police. When they arrived at the scene, Clayton was still there. When the officer entered the bedroom, he asked Clayton what he had done, to which he replied, "I killed her." When asked why, he replied, "because of the emotional pain she has caused me for over the past year." Tragically, It was already far too late for Sophie. She was pronounced dead at the crime scene. She had been stabbed a total of 216 times. You can see a photograph of the weapon that was used on the Vodacast app. Sophie's friends rushed to Facebook to leave messages of condolence on her Facebook page. Adeline Chua wrote, "You were too young to leave us. Rest in peace, Sophie. We will miss your smile." While Amy Lenz wrote, "I'm still in disbelief. I think we are all in shock. You never think anything will happen to someone you know." Sophie's brother Nick told the Sunday Star Times that he believed that Clayton had been plotting to murder his sister for some time. When it dawned on him that she was leaving for good, he decided to act on it. Nick also said that he felt sorry for Clayton's family as well. Sophie's funeral was held at St. Hilda's Chapel on the 15th of January. Hordes of her loved ones packed into the church. Leslie and Gil read out letters that they had written to their daughter, with Leslie stating, "There are so many people here and you said you had no friends." She fondly recalled how her daughter loved teasing her and having her on, and how she always gave her the best advice on hair and fashion. A number of Sophie's friends also shared fond memories, and a video of Sophie singing karaoke was played out. Otago University economics lecturer Robert Alexander recalled how he had just said goodbye to his star student just a week earlier and was looking forward to seeing her again in May when she would return for a break from her new job in Wellington. Former St. Hilda's principal Chris Layton read out a list of achievements that Sophie had and said that her academic prowess did not detract from her other interests, including debating, stage challenge and theatre sports. Her brother Chris played the piano and sang The Other Side by David Gray. Leslie said that she had hoped that there was music, dancing and lots of boys in heaven, and ended the service by releasing 99 red balloons into the sky. You can see a photograph of the balloon release on the Vodacast app. In March, a memorial service for Sophie was held at the University of Otago's Marama Hall. During the service, it was announced that an annual economics prize would be set up in Sophie's name. The memorial followed a similar format to Sophie's funeral. A number of friends and loved ones fondly spoke about Sophie, while prayers were spoken and songs were sung. Following the service, Leslie and Gil, who were in attendance, unveiled a plaque bearing Sophie's name, which was beside a cherry blossom tree which had been planted in her honour. A couple of months later, it was announced that Sophie's brother Chris would be accepting her degree. The year before she was murdered, she had completed a BCom with a first class honours in economics. It was the first time in the university's almost 140-year history that a degree was awarded in person under the circumstances, and Sophie's family felt very grateful, adding that they were going to have a large celebration because it was what Sophie would have wanted. That same month, a pre-trial hearing was held, during which a Crown solicitor said that Sophie had died after being stabbed and cut 216 times with a knife. There had also been 7 blunt force injuries to her body. Leslie testified about the afternoon of the murder. She said that after she managed to get inside Sophie's bedroom, she found Clayton on top of her, just stabbing her lifeless body. She stated, "He was straddled across her legs and she had blood around her neck. The whole room to me seemed like it was red." She said that when she first heard her daughter screaming in the bedroom, she had feared that she was being raped. It had never even crossed her mind that she was being murdered. Clayton's defense attorney, Judith Ablett Kerr, asked Leslie about the relationship between Sophie and Otago University economics lecturer Robert Alexander, who spoke during her funeral. Leslie said that she considered Robert to be a mentor and a friend to her daughter. A former girlfriend of Clayton, whose identity was suppressed, had said that Clayton was obsessed with getting a lectureship at the university and had confided in her that he felt as though Sophie had said something to Robert, who was on the selection panel for the position, and had ruined his chances to get the job. This same girlfriend said that Clayton was obsessive and had a nasty demeanour, particularly while under stress. She also testified that Clayton had spoken to her about his relationship with Sophie. He had told her that the relationship was negative and that Sophie sucked his strength and was mean to him at times. This ex-girlfriend described Clayton as hypersensitive, stuttering. He would take offense where others might be able to deal with it. He gets offended easily and becomes distressed at someone thinking the worst of him. The ex-girlfriend said that she had spoken to Clayton just days before the murder had occurred, and said that he wasn't himself. She said that she was concerned and urged him to get out of the relationship with Sophie. She said that Clayton appeared pleased that Sophie was moving away to Wellington, but said that she was worried about Clayton. She said, "Clearly I wasn't concerned anything untoward was going to happen, but I was concerned enough to say, I think you need a break away." She said that Clayton described Sophie as horrible and said he couldn't believe he had let her influence his life for so long. Robert Alexander, the economics lecturer, would also testify during the pre-trial hearing. He revealed that just the day before Sophie was murdered, she had told him that Clayton told her that he wished she was dead because she had ruined his chances of getting the new job he had wanted. He said that Sophie had often confided in him about things that Clayton said to her, and these things made Robert feel uneasy. She told him that Clayton often belittled her, calling her stupid, fat, and ugly.
Told her that he wished her dead, that he now had a new girlfriend who was 5'10" and such a big step up from her.
He recollected how Clayton had once told Sophie that he was dating a new woman who was 5'10" and a model and was a step up from her. He said that Clayton often made it clear that he believed he was superior to everybody else, including Sophie. He said that Clayton often suggested that his students' work was worthless and that he had frequently demoralized his students. According to Robert, the real reason that Clayton didn't get the job at the university was because he had caused trouble at the university.
It was my opinion that he had little chance based on his conflict with other members of the department, particularly in accusing two senior colleagues of plagiarism.
Clayton had made two separate accusations of plagiarism of his work, one which was against the then head of the economics department. Apparently, Clayton had very few supporters in the department. Robert told the courtroom that he had never brought up Sophie's concerns to any other members in the department and had only been listening to and speaking to Sophie in a personal capacity. This week's episode is sponsored by the podcast Scary Time. Prepare yourself for the scariest, creepiest, and most terrifying stories and conversations, from the cursed tale of Griffith Park to Salem and the Bell Witch. There's something to get everybody's heart racing. Each weekly episode is hosted by a selection of the best content creators, and they cover cases such as paranormal hauntings, aliens, creepy places, strange phenomena, and everything in between. So wrap yourself up tight in bed, make sure your door is locked, and subscribe to Scary Time across all podcast platforms. The link is in my show notes. One of Sophie's best friends, Jessica Smith, would also testify in regards to how Clayton treated Sophie. She said that he didn't treat her as an equal and always treated her as if she was stupid. She said that he often called Sophie fat and ugly and revealed that there had been physical abuse in the relationship. She began to cry as she recollected how on one occasion, Clayton had picked Sophie up, took her into his bedroom and then threw her on the bed. He then got on top of her, straddled her and had his arm against her throat. She said that Clayton was yelling at Sophie. He had gone from saying how much he loved her and how she was the one for him to calling her fat and ugly, and telling her that she was a whore. She said that Sophie managed to get away from Clayton. She ran to her car and he ran after her, screaming that he wished her plane crashed when she flew back from a holiday in Australia. Jessica said that she had tried to encourage Sophie to go to police, but she didn't want to because she had no bruises and was leaving for Wellington soon anyway. Under cross-examination by defence Ablett Kerr, Jessica said that Sophie often feared that she was not attractive enough for Clayton. She asked, "Did she complain to you that it was not satisfying as a sexual relationship, as far as she was concerned?" To which Jessica replied, "Yes." Another friend, Erin Vandewater, testified that Sophie felt as though the relationship would be more satisfactory if she could fix the flaws that Clayton was constantly putting her down over. The court would also hear from Sarah Forbes, a friend of Clayton. She testified that on the morning of Sophie's murder, Clayton appeared to be in good spirits. It was his birthday, and he was excited about plans for his celebrations that evening. She said that Clayton had referred to Sophie as his psycho girlfriend in the past, and said that when she met Sophie, she thought that she was possessive and jealous. However, when questioned further about this, she said, "That was my interpretation that came about through the reputation that had been actively constructed for me. The way I saw her behaviour that night was through a lens that had been given to me." When defence, Ablett Kerr, suggested she now look at it through a lens that saw Clayton kill Sophie, Sarah said, "That's not a lens, that's a fact." To which defence Ablett Kerr replied with, "We'll see about that." She then testified that Clayton had asked her to come to his office the day before Sophie was murdered. Over the course of 2 hours, Clayton talked about Sophie. He said that he was concerned about her because she had allegedly arrived at his office the day beforehand, shaking and sweating. He claimed that she had hit him in the face with her elbow, apparently reenacting what she alleged was an earlier assault by Clayton on her. She then apparently said, "Now we're even." He spoke about the earlier assault on Sophie, but claimed that she had come to his home, yelling and screaming, and had tried to hit him repeatedly. He claimed that he had pushed her onto the bed, simply as a way to restrain her. After the 4-day pretrial hearing, Justice of the Peace Ashley Broad told Clayton that there was sufficient evidence against him to go to trial for the murder of Sophie. He asked Clayton if he wanted to plead guilty, to which he replied, "No." In early February, Clayton's defence team applied to have the murder trial moved out of Dunedin, alleging that it would be impossible to get a fair trial there. The delay in the trial felt like a slap in the face to Sophie's family. Her mother Leslie told the Sunday Star Times that the family was worn out by the waiting, stating, "We are in limbo. We can't make any decision about our future. We have been like this for over a year now." According to Justice Ministry statistics, courts across New Zealand were under increasing pressure to send cases to jury trial in a timely manner. In 2008, the average waiting time for a trial to begin in the Dunedin High Court was 285 days. In 2006, it was just 112, meaning that it had more than doubled. Ultimately, the judge would agree to move the trial to Christchurch, and it began on the 24th of June 2009. On the first day, it was announced that Clayton had admitted to manslaughter but denied murder. During opening statements, Crown Counsel Mary Grills laid out the facts of the case. She detailed how on the 9th of January, Clayton had shown up to the Elliott family home. He was led in by Leslie after saying that he had something for her daughter. Unbeknownst to Leslie or to Sophie, Clayton had a kitchen knife in a small computer bag, which he had brought along with him. She revealed during her opening statements the full extent of Sophie's injuries. Up until now, the grim details of her murder had been suppressed. Sophie had been attacked with such brutality that her ears and the tip of her nose had been cut off. There were stab wounds to her eyes, her throat, a breast, her genital area, and to other parts of her body. Some of her hair had also been cut off. Crown Counsel Grills told the jury that it was no coincidence that some of the clusters of wounds to Sophie related to areas of her beauty and attractiveness. Clayton had started the attack with the knife he had brought to the home with him, and then midway through he started stabbing Sophie with a pair of scissors. During opening statements of defence, Ablett Kerr, she essentially blamed Sophie's murder on herself. She said that Clayton was ill-equipped to deal with the emotional pain of the relationship, which she referred to as torrid and tumultuous, and said that this was because of his unique personality makeup. She said that Clayton had been provoked into losing the power of self-control and killing Sophie. She said that the relationship between Clayton and Sophie had impinged Clayton's personal and professional life, and she even alleged that Sophie had attacked Clayton with a pair of scissors, and he responded by stabbing her over 200 times with a kitchen knife that he had brought along with him to her house. The defense contended that it was manslaughter, not murder, and that the jury would need to focus on the behavioral aspects of both Sophie and Clayton and decide what the proper level of culpability was in the case. The first witness to be called to testify was Leslie. She took the courtroom through the heartbreaking and disturbing events of that morning.
I raced upstairs at the first scream, and she just started screaming and screaming and screaming. And I belted on the door. I tried the door and it was locked. I kicked the door and belted it and screamed at Clayton to open it, but he didn't.
She described the moment she finally managed to get into Sophie's bedroom after hearing her scream. By this point, Sophie had fallen silent, and all she could hear was a rhythmic sound, which she thought was a headboard banging against the wall. She said that at first she feared that Clayton was raping Sophie. When she opened the door, she saw Clayton straddling Sophie. She testified, his arm was going up and down. I thought he was stabbing right through her. That was what the rhythmic noise was. Leslie said that she began to scream and Clayton leaned over and slammed the door. She was already on the phone to police at this point. Leslie told the jury that as soon as she opened the door and saw her daughter, she knew that she was dead. She said that Sophie was lying on her back in the corner of the room, surrounded in a pool of her own blood. She said that her eyes were dead white, and she was staring into nothingness. She said that she could see that Sophie was bleeding from the eyes, and there was blood across her chest. She stated, I don't know why I stepped out of the room. I wish I hadn't, but I did. He was still stabbing her. I suppose it was all a bit of shock, really. I stepped back, and I didn't resist him closing the door. She told the jury that before her murder, Sophie had been upset when she described to her mother assaults on her by Clayton, the most recent of which was 2 days before the murder. She revealed that on this occasion, Sophie had gone to the university with a check for Clayton for repairs to a glass door pane she had broken around 10 days earlier at his home when he had attacked her and restrained her. Clayton told her that they needed to talk and denied the earlier attack. According to Leslie, this denial infuriated Sophie and she pushed Clayton, put her arm against his neck with a hand over his mouth. She said that she wanted to do to him what he had done to her. Leslie said that when Sophie told her about this incident, she was crying and asking why Clayton hated her so much. She told the jury that she had advised her daughter to go to police, but Sophie didn't want to because she was leaving for Wellington. Under cross-examination by defence Ablett Kerr, Leslie said that at first she'd been concerned about the relationship between Sophie and Clayton because he was one of her lecturers. She said that the relationship was weird and unlike any other relationship that Sophie had ever been in. She elaborated by stating that there was no usual starry-eyed and loving behaviour which is typical in the early stages of a relationship. She said that Sophie was typically very loving and cuddly but saw none of this in her relationship with Clayton. She said that Sophie had confided in her that it appeared as though Clayton led two separate lives and that he had a whole set of other people that she didn't know about. Defense Ablett Kerr suggested that before Sophie started to scream, she had shouted, "Fuck you, Clayton." Leslie said she doubted that her daughter had said that and said that she had heard her shout either, "Don't, Clayton," or "Stop it, Clayton." She accepted that she had told police she didn't hear Sophie screaming until a couple of minutes after she last saw her downstairs. However, she had earlier said she heard Sophie screaming within seconds of her going up to the bedroom. Testimony would then be heard from Christine Haig, a departmental administrator. She testified that 5 days before Sophie was murdered, she had spoken with Clayton and he appeared to be in good spirits. He told her that he had just gotten out of a bad relationship and was happy that it was over. He told her that it had been a rough year for him, but he was pleased. He had completed his PhD and was looking forward to trying out some new things, such as learning French and learning salsa dancing. Sarah Forbes, Another friend of Clayton testified that Sophie had added her on Facebook, even though they had only met once. When she informed Clayton of this, he told her not to accept the friend request, because Sophie would try and monitor her account. He had told Sarah that Sophie was very insecure with their relationship, and she was doing spot checks at his house. She would allegedly show up in the middle of the night and try and make sure that no other woman was staying over. Sophie's best friend, Jessica Smith, who testified during the pre-trial hearing, would be called as a witness. She broke down in tears as she relayed the fears she had that Clayton would one day seriously harm Sophie. She said that Sophie had promised her that she would not go and see Clayton to give him the check for the pane of glass that she had smashed when he attacked her. Testifying, she said, "I was so scared after what he had done the last time, but she wanted to get things resolved." The day before the murder, Sophie had told her about meeting Clayton by chance just the previous day. Sophie confided in Jessica that Clayton had called her mentally deranged. Jessica also told the jury how Clayton often called Sophie horrible names, made cruel remarks about her appearance and intelligence, and accused her of being spoilt and living off her parents, which was an insult that really hurt Sophie. Under cross-examination, Jessica said that text messages between herself and Sophie the day before the murder had mentioned Sophie's previous boyfriend. His name was suppressed and he was referred to as Man A. Sophie and Man A had dated for 3 years before breaking up, shortly before she got with Clayton. Jessica recalled a letter written to Sophie from another man, known as Man D, in which he said that he was in love with her and was going to break up with his girlfriend to be with her. Jessica said she couldn't recall a conversation in which Sophie had said that she was going to tell Man D's girlfriend about what he had been saying to her, because Man D was being a wimp.
Sophie got very drunk one night and ended up in bed with a person called...
Yes.
And Sophie met up with a Dutch person, I think he's been described as Danish, and you're aware that that encounter was also involved sexual intercourse taking place?
Yes.
It was obvious that the defence were trying to imply that Sophie was a bit of a troublemaker and promiscuous. They would call on Aaron Van de Water, a good friend of Sophie, who said that she had suspected that Sophie was sleeping with a married man who she had met through work. She had pestered Sophie for information, and Sophie wrote about Aaron in her diary, referring to her as a dog that could smell her fear about the illicit relationship. After December of 2007, when Sophie broke up with Clayton, she admitted to Aaron that she had been sleeping with the married man. Jessica also testified that when they were on holiday in Australia in November, Sophie had slept with two men, but as mentioned, the relationship between her and Clayton was always on and off. Aaron would tell the jury about some of the horrid things Clayton had said to Sophie during their relationship.
He said that her chin was too pointy, her eyes were too far apart. He said that he listed each thing individually. He said, told her to look at how disgusting she was.
Testimony would be heard from a former girlfriend of Clayton whose name was suppressed. She testified that she had been in a relationship with Clayton from 2004 until August of 2007. She said that Clayton could be kind and generous, but he had an extremely mean streak and would often say demeaning things to her about her intelligence and her appearance. On one occasion, Clayton had forced her to compare his genitalia to her former boyfriend, and when she grudgingly answered, he got angry and said, "I can't believe you'd tell me that. It's such an insensitive thing to say." On another occasion, she was attempting to sleep and Clayton was playing guitar. She had asked him several times to stop, but he ignored her requests, forcing her to put her hand on his guitar and suggesting he play somewhere else. Clayton responded by jumping up and down on top of her on the bed. She said that in 2006 she had tried to break up with Clayton, and he flew into a violent rage.
And he kicked me in the back and in the ribs. And then I travelled across the floor and
next thing I knew, he jumped on the back of my neck. He at times could have a very nasty mean streak, and he did it on various occasions, say fairly demeaning things to me.
He kicked her, sending her flying across the floor. He had also kicked her in the back, ribs and knee, and also on the nose. He then took away her keys to prevent her from leaving the house, stating that he simply wanted to talk about the incident. This same woman had remained in contact with Clayton after the breakup and said that he was obsessed with Sophie. 2 nights before the murder, he had called the woman and kept going on and on about Sophie, criticising her and saying he couldn't believe that he had let somebody so negative into his life. The woman had tried to calm Clayton down, reminding him that Sophie was much younger than him, but said that he wouldn't let it go. He reiterated his fears that Sophie had ruined his chances of getting the job. It would be revealed during trial that 5 days after murdering Sophie, Clayton had written a letter to this former girlfriend from jail. She read part of the letter out in court.
I am also sorry that such a horrible person has been glorified in the media. That is our society, sad face.
Another former girlfriend, who also remained anonymous, also testified during trial. She testified that living with Clayton was like walking on eggshells. She said that she had learned to become quite careful with him because anything could set him off, and he would really go off. She said that the relationship was generally loving and kind, but she found it stressful when Clayton was stressed, stating he had two sides, a loving and generous side and a nasty, mean side, which he seldom showed in public. She said that there was an element of fragility to his personality. This woman had actually written to Clayton following his arrest, telling him that a lot of people were rooting for him and that he should dig deep and find those coping skills. However, she quickly stopped responding after finding out the full extent of what Clayton had done. At first, she thought it may have been a mistake, something that had happened in a moment of shock and heat. I've recently become obsessed with Foreo, and they've sponsored this episode. Foreo exists to reinvent beauty and wellness by offering innovative devices that install confidence and improve your skin. I've been using the Luna 3, which features thin touch points for cleansing your face. I've also been using the UFO Mini, which is a 90-second face treatment utilizing hyper-infusion technology. It leaves my skin glowing and radiant in just 90 seconds. I have quite sensitive skin, and Foreo genuinely leaves my skin feeling amazing. I've also been using the massage function on Luna 3, which directs lower frequency pulsations to wrinkle-prone areas and smooths the appearance of fine lines. I've been doing this for a couple of weeks now and already see a difference in the look and feel of my skin. Foreo are offering Morbidology listeners an Amazon bundle, which includes the Luna 3, the UFO Mini, and Call It A Night UFO Activated Mask. The set is valued at $307.99 and retails on Amazon at $249. But with the code MORBID50, you can get it for $199. There are 2 other bundles, but that's the one I've got. It's been a tough year and a half for all of us, and it's about time we deserve to have that moment of pampering zen. I swear by their products now and use them every single day. Just click the link in my show notes to the Amazon bundles, or go to Foreo's Amazon shop and click the bundles tab and use code MORBID50 for 35% off. Is there something interfering with your happiness, or are you apprehensive about reaching out for help? BetterHelp is here to help you, and they're today's sponsor of Morbidology. BetterHelp is not self-help, it's professional counselling available to you online or over the phone. BetterHelp is more affordable and accessible than traditional offline counselling, and they offer financial aid. Sadly, sometimes traditional offline counselling is not locally available for everybody, but BetterHelp is available for clients worldwide. They have licensed professional counsellors specialising in a broad variety of areas, including depression, sleeping, self-esteem, grief, and much more. Everything you share with your counsellor is confidential and they are matched to your specific needs. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/morbidology. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/morbidology. Testimony would then be presented in regards to the crime scene at the home. Detective Constable Joanne Mary McLaughlin testified that when she entered Sophie's bedroom, she found her body laying on top of an open suitcase, with her legs on the floor. She spotted a small pair of black-handled scissors on the carpet between Sophie's legs. The scissors were stained with blood. Nearby, she found a silver knife which was also stained with blood. There was a large quantity of blood surrounding Sophie's body, as well as spattered on the wall in the corner and to the left of the door. The suitcase contained Sophie's clothing, which she had been packing in preparation for the big move. A clump of hair was also found in the suitcase. There was also blood evidence, which indicated that Sophie had been dragged across the floor during the attack. Detective Graham Smeal told the jury that when he searched Clayton's home, he found that a kitchen knife was missing from the Wiltshire knife block. He compared the knife block and other knives to the knife that was found at the crime scene, and reached the conclusion that the knife used in the murder had come from this knife block, meaning that Clayton had arrived at Sophie's home armed with a knife. Dr. Martin Sage, the pathologist who conducted Sophie's autopsy, told the jury that Sophie had fought desperately for her life during the frenzied attack. There were defensive wounds to her arms, fingers, and legs, and it was estimated that she could have been alive for quite a few minutes. He testified that she had died from an extraordinary array of multiple wounds. There were two lethal injuries which included a penetrating wound through Sophie's heart and another through her lung. He said that her body had 11 clusters of focused stab wounds. Her ears had been cut off. There were stab wounds to her eyes and a number of wounds to her throat, which had been inflicted with closed scissors. On the 11th day of the trial, the defence would begin presenting their case. Defence attorney Greg King said that Sophie had slept with two men while on vacation in Australia in November. He said that when Clayton went to her house that day, he asked if he should be tested for an STD.
The deceased, no doubt at her wit's end also with the course of the relationship, screamed out to him, "You, Clayton," lunged at him with a pair of scissors, and in the process knocked off his glasses, leaving him exposed and vulnerable. The defence case is that that is ludicrous. That what occurred was that as a result of provocation, he was deprived of his self-control, and that the tragic and horrific killing of Sophie Elliott occurred.
He made the startling claim that Clayton didn't have his glasses with him and was therefore vulnerable. It was an extremely ludicrous claim from the defence. To stab someone over 200 times with a kitchen knife which you had brought along with you because you couldn't see properly without your glasses. It made very little sense. Clayton would be the first defence witness to testify. He spoke about his childhood, family life and insecurities that he began to experience as a young boy. He said that he was terrified of being teased in school when he got glasses at 11 years old, and said he would become so nervous about exams that he would become physically ill.
I think I was probably a bit more flashy, a bit more image conscious than my brother. I was just terrified. I was terrified of being teased. I mean, now glasses are fashionable, but not back then. It was a source of differentiation and possibly derision from other people. The anxiety made me sick, so to speak.
He said that in the past, he had asked girlfriends to compare his genitalia to their ex-partners, stating that he had done so in the hopes of getting an ego boost.
I said, how big was his sexual organ?
You asked her about the size of this man's penis, is that right?
I think I was after an ego boost. For me. And insecurity.
Did you get the boost you were after?
No, not at all. The way in which it was said, but I mean, I asked for it. Well, I told you what the response was, right? Yeah.
He said that he hadn't gone to Sophie's home that day to kill her, but instead claimed he had gone to return some gifts that she had given him. He admitted to attacking his previous girlfriend, who had testified the week beforehand. He said that at the time he had been concerned about finance and was worried about his academic future. He said that he had sought help from doctors, a psychotherapist, and a psychiatrist for his anxiety issues, the first time of which was in 1998. He said that Sophie could be jealous, abrasive, and insulting, and claimed that on one occasion she had attacked him in bed because he didn't want to have sex with her. He said he felt as though he had been enslaved by Sophie, and that he was being appraised by her and had to appease her. He claimed that he was the one in a controlling and abusive relationship, not Sophie. According to Clayton, Sophie had often compared genitalia of her prior partners, and it made him feel self-conscious and uncomfortable. He told the jury, "I'm fortunate in that regard, but it was almost like she didn't want me to be too sexually confident because I might go elsewhere." The testimony then shifted towards the day that Sophie was murdered. The prosecution contended that Clayton had deliberately targeted aspects of Sophie's physical beauty. When he was asked what parts of Sophie's body he found attractive, Clayton said that she did not have the kind of body that he liked on a woman, stating, "She was okay, but nothing specific attracted me to her." He denied that he had ever called her ugly and denied that when he went to her home on the 9th of January, he had not set about damaging her looks and her features of physical beauty. When asked why he had chopped her hair off, he said he didn't know because he couldn't remember doing it. He answered the same when he was asked why he had mutilated Sophie. In fact, he denied he remembered disfiguring particular areas of her body.
Why did you cut parts of both her ears off?
I don't know.
Is it just a coincidence? They're all features of attractiveness.
Well, I don't... My personal view of attractiveness is that those features are not important. I suppose it's how they correlate with one another and how they aligned and everything else. You can't just have nice ears and, you know, it's the whole package. So, and that's generically, she was attractive.
Why did you cut the nipple off her breast?
I don't know.
Stab her in both eyes?
I don't know.
You remember doing all those things, I suggest?
I don't. I would have, in evidence in chief, told you everything I did.
Because you would tell the truth if you remembered it.
Absolutely.
You remembered where the knife was when the officer asked you? You remember that, don't you? You were able to convey that straight away?
I had some time before the officer came into the room, but, Mr. Bates...
go looking for the knife.
No, please.
You'd have to tell me specifically what I said in order for your question to say that I recalled.
Did you remember that where the knife was or not? How's your memory on that?
I knew it was in the area around Sophie. But if you could recall the comment that I made to the officer that justifies the question, and then we'll go from there.
Plenty of time. We'll do that when we come to that
cool.
Day. You indicated, you remembered, you'd use the knife first and the scissors later. Is that something you remember?
That's something I deduced from having had the memories, as I said, of the cut on my hand, having seen the memory of, felt the memory of the scissors. So definitely the scissors at the end and the cutting of my hand with some sort of blade, I assumed it was the knife.
You just told us you remember that you didn't lock the door. Is that correct?
At what stage?
Any stage.
Yeah, true. Yep, that's right.
So you remember that, not locking the door, is that what you're saying?
No. I don't... Okay, let's flip it around. I don't recall locking the door. I don't recall not locking the door.
You can remember everything up until the time that you say Sophie waved some scissors at you. That's basically what you've told us, isn't it?
As I say, there's something unintelligible said before she said, fuck you, Clayton. I don't recall that. I was distracted. So I don't think it's that deterministic or convenient, because it's not convenient, because I don't like being in a position where I can't answer questions. I'd rather know all the answers and be able to provide you with them rather than have a degree of cynicism about my recall. I find that a bit offensive, but that's just the way it is, Mr. Bates.
He claimed that his memory of the murder was very contained to quite small pieces of information. He said that memory is good when a person is not stressed and was in control. He said that he only had one vivid memory, and that was of a crushing sound. He said he recalled standing or kneeling over Sophie with a pair of scissors in his hand. When asked if he killed Sophie, after she attacked him with scissors, he replied, "I think in some respects, it was the straw that broke the camel's back. It's quite hard to answer." After the murder, he said he felt a big release and laughed as he told the court, "I thought she was more than likely dead. Presumably, I thought. I mean, I didn't know." He claimed that when he went to Sophie's house that day, it was never his intention to kill her. He said his goal was to take the moral high ground and leave her home with her knowing that she had behaved badly during their relationship. He said he brought up the topic of Sophie sleeping with two men while in Australia, telling the jury she wasn't happy about that topic being raised, and said that she wasn't a slut and she had known that guy for a couple of days. He claimed that as he tried to leave, Sophie came at him with a pair of scissors. When asked why, he had brought a kitchen knife with him. He claimed that he had carried the knife in his laptop bag since the middle of 2006, stating that he was concerned about personal safety. The prosecution also pointed out that Clayton had locked the door before attacking Sophie, which clearly indicated premeditation. During cross-examination, the prosecution stated, "We've been here for several hours and you've taken responsibility for nothing. You're putting it all onto other people." Prosecutor Robin Bates asked Clayton if he understood the meaning of the word responsible. He denied that he was taking every single possibility to try and suggest that Sophie was promiscuous and vulgar in relation to prior relationships. However, in Sophie's diary, she had written that Clayton was high maintenance and constantly pressed her for details of prior relationships, and then became angry or upset when she gave those details. Prosecutor Bates suggested that it was another example of Clayton taking one set of facts and blaming the other people for what arose out of his obsession. While on the witness stand, Clayton would shockingly refer to Sophie as an attempted murderer, despite the fact he had no injuries to himself other than a small cut on his hand, which was most likely inflicted when he was murdering Sophie. He said that he resented Sophie's contrived legacy. Prosecutor Bates would read an entry from Sophie's diary. It was dated the 27th of December, 2009. She wrote, "Lord, I hardly know where to start. Clayton assaulted me. When I went to leave, he went absolutely psycho. No exaggeration at all, I assure you. He told me I'm a fucking horrible person. Everyone hates me. I'm fucking ugly. He never liked me, etc. All while pinning me down with his entire body on his bed." She wrote that she was extremely scared of Clayton and that he was furious and unreasonable. Clayton responded by stating that Sophie's version of the incident was embellished and a fantasy, stating, "It's Pride and Prejudice, you've seen it. She's Mrs. Bennet and I'm Mr. Darcy. It's Mills and Boone. This whole dramatic stuff didn't occur." Clayton's former Otago University academic supervisor, Professor Dorian Owen, then told the courtroom how just the day before Sophie was killed, he had advised Clayton to just leave Sophie alone, stating, "I told Clayton to keep his head down as Sophie would be leaving soon. Everyone knew she was leaving and that the relationship would come to an end." He said that when speaking to Clayton the day before the murder, he said that he had been having a hard time with Sophie, that he was concerned about her temper and her outbursts. Clayton indicated to Professor Owen that he did not expect to see Sophie again. Professor Owen testified that when he heard about what had happened, he was of course shocked by the actions of Clayton, but also due to the fact that he went over to her house. He described Sophie as not particularly calm or laid back, adding that she was expressive and theatrical, and not afraid to talk in class. He said that she was forceful in the way that she spoke. He described Clayton as pleasant and said that he was always a very calm person. He said that Clayton had told him in the past that Sophie was controlling. Under cross-examination by Prosecutor Grills, Professor Owen denied making comments about Sophie's breasts to Clayton and said that he was surprised that Clayton had attributed such a comment to him. Testimony in regards to Clayton's mental health would also be presented. Dr. David Chaplow told the jury that Clayton was not mentally ill at the time of the murder, but had features of anxiety disorder and personality features of narcissism and obsessionality. He said that there were indications of considerable maladaptiveness and problems with social and other interpersonal relationships. Dr. Philip Brinded had also interviewed Clayton in prison and said that his significant lack of empathy or remorse for the murder of Sophie was evident. He testified that Clayton had taken no responsibility for what had happened during the relationship or what he had done. He also said that Clayton had attempted to control the interview by using a handwritten chronology of events that he had prepared and became increasingly anxious and resistant to questioning that forced him to deviate from the chronology. In fact, Clayton had said that Sophie was responsible for the state of affairs which he had found himself in, meaning that Sophie was responsible for her own murder. Dr. Brinded said to the jury that it was his opinion that the defence of insanity could be ruled out as well, as the idea that Clayton had committed the murder in an unconscious, automatic state. Dr. Brinded was the last witness to testify. Next up were the closing arguments. Prosecutor Bates said that Clayton had attempted to rewrite history in a bid to avoid responsibility for what he had done. He said that Clayton had told different people different things about his relationship with Sophie, adding that just days before she was murdered, Clayton had told her that he wished that she was dead. He reminded the jury that Clayton went to Sophie's house that day, armed with a knife and had locked her door, stating that he had clearly decided that he was going to kill her and didn't want to be disturbed. Countering this defence, Ablett Kerr said that Clayton was provoked to the point that he lost all self-control. There were audible gasps in the courtroom and some in attendance, even stormed out when he suggested that Leslie was not a reliable witness, because what she saw that day must have traumatized her. While summing up the case, Justice Judith Potter said to the jury that the pivotal issue in deciding whether Clayton was guilty was whether the defense of provocation had been excluded. Since Clayton had admitted to manslaughter but denied murder, two questions for the jury were whether Clayton had killed Sophie with murderous intent, and if so, had the Crown proved beyond a reasonable doubt that he was not acting under provocation? Murderous intent is an essential element of a murder charge, and the jury needed to look at all of the evidence presented carefully. The jury wouldn't take long to reach a verdict. After 5.5 hours, they dismissed Clayton's ludicrous claims of provocation and found him guilty of Sophie's murder. As the verdict was read out, Clayton showed no emotion. Outside of the courtroom, defence Ablett Kerr hugged both Gil and Leslie. Clayton's mother, Eileen Weatherston, also hugged Leslie. Leslie and Gil made a brief statement, saying that what Clayton had done came as a great shock to them, but said that they hoped he gets the help he needed while behind bars. The trial had angered a lot of people for how Clayton had tried to portray Sophie. Outside of court, her father said that the provocation defence should no longer be an option. He said that Sophie didn't have time to provoke Clayton, that he came to her home armed with a knife and locked the bedroom door. He was there for one reason, and one reason alone. He said that the trial had been extremely tough on the family, not only because of the horrific injuries that were inflicted on Sophie, but because of the distortions and embellishments of truth about Sophie and her life. Heather Hanair, Women's Refuge chief executive, agreed, stating, "Because of the way the defence was run, this trial became a pervasive opportunity for a killer to continue to persecute his victim and her family after her death." She described the provocation defence as being based on archaic notions about violence, adding that in one point in time, Society accepted that an affront to male privilege or dignity was a reasonable excuse to fly into a homicidal rage. Clayton would be back in court in September for the sentencing hearing. Clayton would apologise for the murder of Sophie, but through his defence lawyer. Defence Ablett Kerr told the courtroom that Clayton had told her he understood that people did not see that he was remorseful for what he had done, and that he had heard much of what people had said about him. She said that Clayton had told her that people who say these things don't see him at 2 a.m. in the morning when he thinks about the horrendous thing that occurred, stating, "He tells me he is sorry, that he saw no point in saying it himself because it would appear contrived." Sophie's family were able to provide victim impact statements. Leslie revealed that she had undergone hours of counselling for flashbacks of Sophie's murder. She said that she had hopes that one day she will be able to think of Sophie how she was when she was alive, and not the image she had of her daughter in her head, pale and covered in blood. Leslie said that she still cried herself to sleep each and every night, and had to take medication to keep functioning on a daily basis. Turning to Clayton, she said, "Clayton Weatherston, this is what you have done to us. I hope her screams of agony ring in your ears as they do in mine." Gail said that he was still struggling to come to terms with what had happened to his daughter, stating, "Everything I had existed for stopped that day." He said that Sophie had been mutilated so badly that they had been advised not to see her body before her funeral. Speaking directly to Clayton, he said, "You are the epitome of evil." Clayton Weatherston would be given a mandatory life sentence without the possibility of parole for 18 years. Following the sentencing, Justice Minister Simon Parr took heed to what Gill had said about the provocation defence and announced that killers could no longer use this defence. In November of that year, the defence of provocation was abolished. In 2010, Sophie's family would launch the Sophie Elliott Foundation. The purpose is to raise awareness about domestic violence and abusive relationships. Speaking of the foundation, Leslie said, "I know that she is up there and I know that this is what she wants. She wouldn't want her life to be in vain."
I guess the message that I really want to get out there is for young people to be aware of the signs of abuse. We want to zero tolerance to abuse, basically. The biggest message I want to get out there is just to young people that it's not okay to abuse, and that's guys and girls. And, you know, I want to acknowledge that we know that boys do get abused as well. It always sounds like it's a bit of boy bashing, but it's not at all. So that the message from Sophie's story, and as people know that she died at the hands of an abuser, that is that it's not okay, and if you see something going on, to either talk to the person that's being abused or talk to somebody that might be able to help them to see it. Because often when they're in a relationship, they can't always see what's going on. Need somebody from outside to sort of look in and say, you know, hey, this is not okay, sort of thing.
Around 14 women are murdered by their partners or ex-partners in New Zealand each and every year. The murder of Sophie Elliott was a chilling reminder that extreme partner violence can occur in all sectors of society, and it is not restricted to couples who live together. Clayton Weatherston was a textbook perpetrator of domestic violence. There were warning signs that Sophie was in danger, but the sad reality was that nobody realised how serious these signs were. While the guilty verdict brought some closure to Sophie's family, the scars of what they saw that afternoon run deep, as does the trauma of how the trial unfolded and how Sophie was essentially blamed for her own murder. In the aftermath, however, the archaic provocation defence was abolished, and that brings the family hope that no family will ever have to experience what they did. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporters, Paulina, Blake, Hillary, Glenda, and Sarah. If you'd like to support the show on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. In return for your support, you get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, merch, ad-free and early release episodes, behind the scenes and much more. Can I also ask you guys a massive, massive favour and ask if you could vote for Morbidology for Listener's Choice at the British Podcast Awards? Indie podcasts never get a look in for the regular categories, but it would be amazing for an indie podcast to have a shot at their Listener's Choice. I've included the link in the show notes and it literally takes about 2 seconds, and I would be eternally grateful. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing podcast, Scary Time. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
What time is it? Are you scared?
What time is it?
Prepare yourself for the scariest, creepiest, and most haunting stories and conversations from the best independent creators.
What time is it?
When the girl asked her grandmother what was inside, her grandmother spit 3 times through her fingers, said a dibbick and kesselim.
So the soul of a person who died unnaturally will typically linger at their grave, unable to join their ancestors until the gods approve. This is when a bokor would use a bottle or jar to capture the soul and can then control the undead body or simply use the soul on its own.
It's not nighttime, but it's getting dark.
Oh gosh, that's even worse.
And they go to the basements of this house, right? And there's like demonic symbols all over the walls,
okay,
and shit.
That's
a pentagram on the floor.
He can't explain or shake the feeling of the crying baby sounds coming from the woods. Now, as if hearing voices and babies crying weren't creepy enough, this is absolutely crazy to me. He claims that he hears his name called out from the forest.
Ghosts, creatures, freaky places,
what times?
Weird experiences, haunted objects, and so much more.
What times?
Put your feet in the covers and turn on a nightlight.
Someone please tell me what time it is!
It's scary time. Subscribe now.